Welcome to the Edible Valley Podcast. I'm Blaine Prose.
And I'm Jonathan Fraser. And we're glad to have you along with us for another, as we like to call it, an adventure of the Comox Valley, or as we like to think of it, our Edible Valley. So we're going to have a nice little sit down today and chat and have some fun, I think.
Yeah, in studio are Arzina Hamir from Amera Farm in, what are you, North Courtney or South Merville?
I'm, that's a good question.
Depends, if,
depends on who's asking. Well, I think technically we're still in Courtney.
Okay, so
but I like to be called an official Mervillian too. So,
every guest we've had so far that lives in Merville, we've asked them how many pairs of gumboots they own. So.
Oh, you mean the household or personally?
Well, personally,
probably about
really
three.
Yeah. So you're close enough to say you live in Merville.
Oh, awesome. Yeah. Awesome.
Yeah. Megan Halstead. It took her a bit to count up all her pairs. She had a lot, like eight or something crazy. She had her pig boots and her cow boots and her garden boots. And
yep.
Yeah. So we were all over the place with that one.
That's hilarious.
So anyways, we'll start out like we normally do and talk a little bit about what's new and what's been happening in the last week in our world.
Well, you can start out with me, and that's been, well, I guess a lot, but not much, because I've been stuck in the cafe again, which isn't bad, because I've been able to actually get out and connect with a bunch of farms that I haven't been able to over the last couple of weeks, so.
Good.
Got in a lot of fresh produce from a bunch of places this week, so.
Excellent.
Finally got in hold of Freedom Farm again, because I kind of fell off with them a bit, and got to do some nice fresh stuff from there. Bates Beach, got some tomatoes from them this week, so.
Yep.
A lot of great stuff coming out of a lot of the farms in town right now. So it's been really, really good for me.
Yeah. Definitely. Oh, for sure. Yeah.
It makes me look good, I guess, because again, when you have great product to start with, you can produce great food. So.
Yeah. I didn't have too much of a food weekend aside from eating a whole bunch of wild manila clams from Tree Island that I dug. I went camping over there on Saturday night with my daughter and her little friend. We hiked from Denman Island on Saturday morning and spent the night and came home on Sunday. It was a quick little adventure, but it was fun. And
so you hiked across the sandbar there?
Yeah, we crossed the sandbar. It was no problem. There was lots of beach. I mean, when we came home on Sunday, I think low tide was around 1 o'clock and we left camp at 10 and there was enough beach to cross. So yeah, it was fine. Plenty of low tide there.
It's a great spot to go hang out if you have a boat or just kayak over there.
Yeah, like it's a bit, it's quicker to take your own boat over, of course, but I don't have a boat, so I'll borrow BC Ferries and they can take me across. It's a lot cheaper than owning your own boat, but I wouldn't want to have to do it constantly.
True.
Yeah. Yeah, it's too bad I didn't have more time because Denman has a lot of great little farms and little stands on the sides of the roads over
there
too.
Yeah, definitely a lot of interesting stuff happening on both Hornby and Denman Island. Actually,
yeah.
Those two islands have some really neat stuff. Being part of the Comox Valley, it's always interesting to hear what's happening over there. So.
Yeah, we'll have to take an Edible Valley trip over and have a tour around, John.
I would. That the Hornby Island is sort of my home because that's where I started school. So
that's right. Yeah,
I always look back at it and I know all the great clam picking spots and oyster spots on there.
Yeah.
A couple salmon beds there. There's a lingcod hole, I know. Secret spot, but size of logs down there.
Your dad found it when he was scuba diving?
He was scuba diving once and went down there and saw logs. So what he thought were logs, and when he got down to this hole in the bottom of the ocean there, he saw they were like lingcods, and so pretty impressive. So.
Yeah, very cool. Yeah, so if you want to read about my adventure this weekend, go to the cynicalcyclist.ca. I wrote the blog up last night, some pictures. I did a little underwater photography with some sea stars and some crabs and things, so it was pretty fun. I was looking for a big enough crab that I could eat over there, a Dungeness crab, and I swam around for about 45 minutes in the eelgrass at low tide, and I found a few small ones. And then I spotted this big one, and I thought, oh, this is it. This is great. And I got myself in position to swoop down from behind and grab it where he couldn't get me. And I touched it, and it didn't move.
Oh.
It was a dead one. Talk about disappointment.
Yeah.
Oh. So, yeah, that was it. But that was still fun to get out. And my dog scared the heck out of me because I was snorkeling looking at the bottom, and he darn near ran right into me while he was swimming along. And yeah, I didn't know what it was. Because when I was a kid, I had an experience with the seal over there swimming up really close to me while I was snorkeling. So I guess I had a little flashback.
A little flashback to seal attacks.
Yeah. Yeah, it was pretty good. So, Arzina, you did something cool this weekend. Do you want to give us a little info on what you did?
Well, my roots are in Richmond, and I'm associated with a group that runs a community farm there called the Sharing Farm.
Okay.
And this week, or this past Sunday, was the fourth annual Garlic Festival.
Right.
And it's the primary fundraiser for the group. So the group actually runs a 3-acre farm and grows food for the Richmond Food Bank.
Oh, okay.
And so, you know, seeing the writing on the wall in terms of grants and things to get funding, the organization figured out that, you know, you got to do some other stuff. So this festival started off maybe selling, I think the first year we sold $700 worth of garlic, and we were so happy with ourselves. And then every year it grew and grew. And yesterday there must have been over 2,000 people at the farm and partaking in all things garlic. So apart from fresh, you know, the actual garlic sales, they had garlic ice cream. There's a cob oven, so they baked garlic focaccia with a arugula pesto, and lineups for both. Mm-hmm. And very disappointed people when at 1:30 it sold out.
I got a disappointed person over here, actually, that I wasn't there.
And then, you know, there was all kinds of workshops going on, like how to plant garlic, there were chefs who were actually doing demos with garlic. So it was amazing. And of course, musicians and all kinds of things for kids and crafts for them to do. So it was really wonderful. It's now become kind of a community event, and people come out and they, you know, they don't balk at the price because we're selling garlic for $3 a bulb.
Right.
But because the funds are going towards a really good cause, people are, and you know, the flavor wise, you can't beat local garlic.
No,
so.
Yeah. No, it's amazing.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah. Absolutely. So I was helping out volunteering there too. So that was really great. Yeah.
Nice.
And all that funds go to the food bank, is that?
Well, it goes to the Sharing Farm Society that runs the farm. And so it helps to pay for staff and fertilizer, you know, all the organic manures. And they run everything organically. So,
cool.
Big expense there.
Yeah.
Is that farm owned by the city or is it?
Yeah, it's a really interesting project. So the land is owned by the city. And the farm is actually inside a City of Richmond park.
Oh, okay.
And so, I mean, there's a bit of history. If the term Terra Nova has ever come up, this area was actually under threat of development. It was in the ALR, got taken out of the ALR. There was a big fight, 17 days of public hearings. And then finally, you know, part of it was developed, about 200 acres, and then the rest was set aside for park. But because of the heritage being agricultural, the City of Richmond Parks allows for farming to happen inside the park because it's a cultural a heritage thing.
Right.
And I mean, the people that walk through and do tours, I mean, many of them are new to Richmond, new to Canada, and they get to see some vegetables for the first time. So it's a huge educational opportunity for people to go through. So
I think that's a neat relationship too with publicly owned land and a nonprofit using that land for
it was probably the first in the Lower Mainland, and now other communities are starting to look at it. Metro Vancouver, so the regional district, owns Colony Farm. I don't know if you know that farm. It's in Coquitlam, and there's over 200 acres there.
Yeah, I think I've heard of the name before. Yeah,
yeah. And so they own that. And again, it used to be a working farm.
Right.
And then got taken over by parks and was, you know, kind of parkified for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And now they'd like to bring back the agricultural heritage. And one of the nice things is that places like that really attract young people who are interested in honing skills and growing food. So, in Terra Nova, at least at the Sharing Farm, I mean, there's an amazing group of young people who are into all kinds of cool stuff. Other than organic farming, mm-hmm. I mean, there's permaculture people. There's people experimenting in bees, in seed saving, in all kinds of amazing projects. An edamame project going on.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Cool. Yeah. They're trialing edamame varieties to see if there are any that could work in Richmond. So,
interesting. That'd be really cool.
No kidding. Local edamame. You don't have to get it from China anymore.
Yeah. Yeah, that's neat. I like all that stuff that, you know, it's encouraging that the amount of young people that are getting interested in these, you know, in bringing back this farming and local agriculture.
Well, it's a skill I think that's sort of been lost over the years.
Yeah.
You know, people have got that disconnect from their food. So it's nice to see that jumping back in and getting their hands dirty again.
Yeah.
So.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's not too late, you know, while we still have land.
And that's right.
Which is really great. Yeah.
Yeah. Because if we don't grow things on it, houses are going to get built on it.
Unfortunately, yes.
Yeah. And then once there's concrete in a house, it's never going to be
not coming back. Yet. No. Unless you got some fish farm in a mega house or something. Yeah. I don't know.
Great. Well, that's cool. Yeah, that'd be a neat event that the Comox Valley could host one day as a garlic festival.
Yeah. And
there's nothing like that.
I think it would be so easy to do here. There are so many great growers who are growing amazing varieties of garlic.
There's a lot of people getting into the garlic here.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't be surprised if we see a small garlic festival next year. I mean, the big thing is to grow it slowly because it can be, I mean, the Sharing Farm, they sold over 650 pounds of garlic in one day.
Wow.
And that took months and months of prep work.
Right.
You know, you're harvesting the garlic and, well, you plant that much garlic, first of all,
right.
Harvest it, dry it. I mean, the funniest story is that to dry that much garlic, they had to find like an airplane hangar to hang it all in.
Yeah, because
there's no barn on the site. So they were like, where do we hang all this garlic? So, and then you got to clean it, and
it's that is a lot of work.
Hours and hours of, and yeah.
Garlic bulbs aren't that heavy, and they're not all that big, so 650 pounds,
that's
a lot of individual pieces.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah.
And a lot of garlic scapes.
Yes.
Yes.
Oh, yeah. Oh, you would have loved the garlic scape vinegars and the garlic scape pestos.
Oh, yeah.
Arugula garlic scape pesto. Yeah.
Sounds delicious.
Yeah.
Now, we had a conversation about this with Drex because he had no idea what they were, and I didn't have any idea what they were until this year, pretty much until I talked to you at the farmer's market. And like, have people been aware of them in Canada for a long time, or is this just really new, or am I just that naive?
No, you know what? I think it is a fairly new phenomenon. So, you know, I don't know if you know the what's happened with the garlic industry in Canada. It took a total nosedive when the Chinese imports started coming in and flooding the market. You know, farmers got out of growing garlic.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And now there's suddenly been a resurgence because people are so tired of the non-taste of imported garlic.
Right.
So what's happened is growers are starting to grow more of the hardneck varieties, the ones that really have a pungent flavor, to kind of just sort of, you know, separate themselves from the supermarket garlic.
Right.
And it's only that garlic that has the scapes.
Okay, right.
So probably previously there was a lot of softneck grown, you know, for braiding. It stores a lot better, but the flavor's not as strong.
Oh,
and so I think more growers are growing the hardnecks now.
Right.
But I did speak to growers like when I was panicking with all 1,000 scapes that I had.
Yeah.
And I said, well, what have you been doing? Oh, we just compost it. And it just, are you kidding me? It's food.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, it's great to see that more and more people are really interested in using. I mean, it's almost like a separate vegetable in itself.
Yeah,
right?
It really is. Yeah.
It's like a cross between an asparagus and a garlic. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's got that nice garlic flavor sweetness to it.
Yeah.
It's
still
a little bit different.
It is.
I even have problems with my cooks because they're scared by it.
What is that?
I'm like, well, it can be a little, you know, fibrous.
Yeah.
You know, it's a little crunchy.
Yeah.
But I'm like, you know, cut it thin or, you know, ferment it or do something like that. And it's great. But so they're all like, and then once they start using it, it's wait, this is
awesome.
I like this.
It's
like an ingredient from a new planet. What is this thing?
Yeah. Like the poor man's asparagus or something like that. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I'm glad that they're not just getting composted because that's such a waste.
No kidding. And I think from now on, I think, you know, folks will probably start looking for it more in the farmer's market because it's really the early garlic. I don't know about you, but my stored garlic usually runs out about March, April time. Yeah. And then it's like, oh, I don't want to go to that supermarket garlic anymore. What do I do? And so,
plus it is an early kind of just a green vegetable too that's fresh.
Absolutely.
So.
Right. Well, I have to admit, we did the 30-day challenge last year.
Yes. Yeah.
And that was showing up there. I think it was like everyone who, all the chefs that were involved with it, showing up at the farmer's market and all being like ready, like, what are we going to get to put on our fresh sheets to impress everyone? And it was like, we got garlic scapes. And a lot of them were like, what?
What is that?
So, I went into a lot of passes.
Cool.
So
cool.
It definitely was. That's really got me going on. Yeah. And I really started enjoying using it. So.
Nice.
Yeah, it was pretty fun answering questions because I got quite a few comments because I'd post pictures on Facebook.
Yeah.
And go, what are those things?
Oh, and it's scapes. Such a
they're,
funny shape. It's awesome.
Yeah. They're so curly and cool. So, all right. Well, maybe Arzina, you could give us a little bit more of a bio on yourself. I mean, you filled us in. You're from Richmond, and you're involved with several things there. So, just kind of how did you get started, your education, some of that sort of stuff?
So, I am a Richmond girl. Grew up in Richmond from the early 70s. And it's hard to sort of describe what made me decide to go into agriculture because my mom's a teacher, my dad's in like business. Mm-hmm. Oh, there's no farming background anywhere in our family.
Right.
And when I told them, you know, in grade 12, dad, I want to go study agriculture, like they just sort of looked at me like, what has happened? But they kind of just sort of said, okay, shrugged their shoulders. And I went to university in Guelph in Ontario.
Okay.
So to the Big Ag University there. And Big Ag is like Big B, Big A, because that's the university where a lot of the biotechnology, genetically modified foods are coming out of.
Yeah.
Now, that was just beginning to start when I was there.
Right.
So it's the university where you go in to learn about production, like big production.
Right.
Not a lot of organic stuff. But I was lucky enough that when I graduated, and the reason I really wanted to go into agriculture, I wanted to do community development work.
Okay.
And I wanted to go overseas. So after graduation, I was accepted with CUSO. It's a nonprofit group that sends trained people overseas with skills. So I got sent to Thailand.
Mm-hmm.
So I lived in Thailand for 2 years.
Wow.
I speak Thai.
Nice.
Well, you have to. Thailand's one of those few countries where English is not spoken very readily, especially in the countryside.
Yeah.
And I was working directly with farmers. So,
you kind of had to.
Oh, absolutely. Yes. Yeah. So, and unfortunately, I didn't really learn to cook very well there.
No.
I mean, Thai food, people in Thailand, people go out to eat a lot. And
so
the number of restaurants and noodle shops and, I mean, there's tons. Mm-hmm. You don't have to learn to cook at all if you don't want to. And it's cheap, it's plentiful, and it's really fresh. So,
yeah.
I know a good Thai curry, but I can't quite cook it from scratch myself.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I did 2 years of agricultural work in Thailand and learned actually a lot about organic production there.
Oh, yeah.
Because I was working with a nonprofit group that was training farmers in how to grow food without pesticides.
Right.
So in Thailand, rice, sugar cane, they use a lot of pesticides there. So this organization was really trying to get farmers off of that. So it was really my first, foray into organics. And then decided I want to kind of study that a bit more and did my master's degree in England. So I was in the south of England in Kent for a year studying sustainable agriculture.
Mm-hmm.
Did another year overseas in India this time. Studying traditional agricultural knowledge, So I got to interview men and women about the different sort of knowledge bases that they knew. Mm-hmm. And then by that time, I think we'd been overseas or at least away from Canada for about 10 years. And we were kind of like, and my husband at this time was, well, we weren't married yet, but we'd been together since Guelph.
Right.
We were kind of getting tired. I'd gotten dengue fever. He'd gotten chicken pox while we were overseas. Yeah. So we decided, you know, really time to go back to Canada. So we came back to Vancouver.
Yeah.
And I actually, my first foray into agriculture and here in BC was with a company called West Coast Seeds.
Right.
So if you do any gardening.
My seeds from them.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. And at that time, it was called Territorial Seeds Canada. So okay. I worked with them for a couple of years. And that was my first time then working with gardeners. And I was kind of the point person. People would call up and say, something is eating my something, something. And it, I just kind of have to figure it out from the symptoms and what they were describing. So I would have like reference. I didn't know it out of the top of my head. Right. I'd have reference books open all over my desk and people could hear me like flipping pages. But I kind of got better at it over time and started, you know, being able to answer people's questions well. So and then I moved on, started my own seed company. For a bit, it was an organic seed company. So at that time, there were very few, even small companies providing organic seed. So I was importing it from California at the time.
Right.
And had two kids in the meantime.
Yeah.
Kind of got a little bit overwhelmed. And then decided to kind of shut the company side of things down and went into kind of volunteering and working in the community. So kind of that's the long story, but after you know my kids were born, I started working with a sharing farm and then got a position as the food security coordinator in Richmond, which is an amazing opportunity to work with the whole spectrum of food.
Right.
So I taught a lot of classes myself. I organized a lot of classes, helped to launch the Garlic Festival. Mm-hmm. We do a World Food celebration, World Food Day in October. And, you know, we started hosting canning sessions because probably here, very same thing. Not a lot of people know how to put food aside. It's not a skill that we had in my family because there was no canning in my family at all.
I've been asking my grandmother a lot of questions because she used to do a lot of canning, right? So.
Well, it got to be really, really popular. Yeah. It's so much so that this year they've started charging $5 a person because we would have it drop in.
Right.
You know, we had a kitchen booked, a teaching kitchen. We had all the equipment. We had jars donated because a lot of older people have basements full of canning jars they want to move out. And so we'd have like all the equipment there. Basically, people just had to bring their main, whatever they wanted to either make a jam or pickle or a salsa.
Right.
We'd have like the salt, the vinegar, all the other stuff. Mm-hmm. And they just got to do it under the supervision of like a, not a master canner, but someone who's had training in safe canning methods.
Right.
And, you know, once you see it done, canning's just not something you can pick up in a book.
Mm-hmm.
There's too many things going on at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
So you got to have to kind of see it. And then once you know how to do it once, usually, you know, once or twice, then you can do it. And it's pretty awesome.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I actually learned from a book, but
yeah.
I'm pretty clever, I guess.
Awesome. Yeah.
A pressure canner. Bought myself a pressure canner last year, so I've been doing salmon, mostly salmon in it, and I've done mushrooms and some soup and tomato sauce.
Part of the whole thing about food security, a lot of people are into the growing of the food,
mm-hmm.
gardening, balcony or even community gardening.
Mm-hmm.
But then once the food is grown,
what do you do with it? Yeah.
Then all of the cooking skills had to come up. So we had a lot of classes teaching people how to cook from scratch.
Right.
Because, you know, a lot of people, you give them an onion and a potato, a tomato, they kind of look at you like, So knife skills, just basic cooking.
Right.
And then canning, absolutely. Canning, dehydrating, fermenting, all the, you know,
sounds
all
like
the stuff
kitchen.
That, I know, there's stuff bubbling away with me too. And I love fermenting, I have to say.
Yeah.
Out of all of them, I like dehydrating too because we make a lot of dried fruit for the kids for snacks.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
But the fermenting side, I think it appeals to the slacker in me. Just doesn't want to like heat up the house to 500 degrees and oh, salt, that's all I need.
Yeah.
And I don't have to like put it in a canner and you hot bath it and awesome.
It's after itself.
And it makes it you know, it's probiotic and it makes vitamin B12. Like, what's there not to like about this? So I hope, you know, a lot more people get into fermenting.
Yeah. I'm really new to it too. Like, I just learned about it a couple of months ago and just captured my imagination in a big way. I went, I need to try this. This just seems so easy.
Yeah.
And now I think I talked about it. Did I talk about it last week? My fermenting crock that I got given to me from my, it was my great grandmother's.
Oh, awesome present.
My mom got it from her and my mom used it as a
flower pot
in it.
Oh,
yeah.
No.
Flowers in it. And so she said, well, it's down at your grandmother's house, so you should go get it. So I went and got it, took it home, cleaned it, put 8 pounds of cucumbers in it, salt water, a couple of grape leaves on top, and a big rock that I found in the beach on the North Island.
Yeah.
And
away you go.
Yeah.
That's
skimmed it a couple of times
now. And it's so awesome. I mean, it's magical. You just put salt, and then it sort of turns into this acidic little thing by itself.
Yeah.
I love it.
Yeah, I'm very excited. And they're probably... I'll probably pull them next week. I don't know, 2 weeks should be good enough.
Oh, yeah.
So.
Yeah, I got into making fermented sodas for the first time this year. So, and we gave out samples during the Bike the Farms tour. And I mean, it turned out really well. I mean, we made a thimbleberry soda. So you use ginger as the natural fermenting kind of starter.
Right.
And then just add a little bit of that liquid into whatever, a flavored syrup that you want. So,
Yeah, that's what Mandolin from Island Soda Works does.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so we had her in here a couple of weeks ago now.
2 weeks ago now.
Yeah.
So.
And yeah, just amazing process.
Yeah. My kids, and because, we don't have pop in the house, but this is like the natural pop that I will allow the kids to have.
Totally.
They're very happy that mom's figured out how to do this.
Michaela, my daughter, jumped right on that too. So.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Now it's one of our trips at the farmer's market.
Nice.
Picking up some sodas.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what brought you to the Comox Valley?
Mm.
How'd you get over on the island?
I know. We were doing so well in Richmond.
Yeah.
I mean, we were loving life in Richmond. It's amazing to work in the community you've grown up in, I have to say. Having had my mom was a teacher, so, you know, she had taught half of Richmond herself. And lots of roots and stuff. But Neil and I both thought that, you know, the time had come that we really wanted to farm ourselves.
Right.
And if you've ever looked at what land prices are in Richmond, I know people complain about the prices in the Comox Valley.
True.
I'm sorry. Come over and have a look. Because, and, you know, with my work in food security, you know, we were addressing the land issue in Richmond a lot.
Right.
So I was keeping my eye out and what land was, you know, selling for. And if you were looking for land under 5 acres, which we were at the time, you in Richmond would have had to pay between $500,000 and $1 million an acre.
Wow.
Which is crazy.
Which
Holy
is insane.
Yeah.
Insane.
You can't
so,
recover.
No. And so that farmland is being sold for starter castles. It's not sold for farming anymore.
Yeah. I guess there's one crop maybe you could grow.
Nothing legal, though.
Nothing legal.
Yeah. And, you know, like a bank would laugh at you. There is nothing you can grow that would recoup your costs if you were trying to finance that. So, you know, we knew we just couldn't stay even in the Lower Mainland. Even if you go into the Fraser Valley, it's still
too
really
much.
Expensive.
Yeah.
So we started looking on the Sunshine Coast first. We tried to, because my whole family is still in Richmond, so we tried to be, you know, only a few hours away.
Right.
But, you know, the Sunshine Coast, we would have had to, like, clear forest and start building the soil. And, you know, we're not that young. So we were looking at each other going, don't want to do that.
Yeah.
So we looked at either the Cowichan Valley or the Comox Valley. And, you know, quite truthfully, we just took a trip and drove through both areas, drove through the downtown of Courtney, and we loved it.
Mm-hmm.
We drove through in February and we even loved it. So
it must have been one of the sunny days.
No, it wasn't. You know, the funny thing is, like, I know people complain about it, but one of the things that triggered me was just the number of privately owned coffee shops in Courtney and the level of the coffee. I mean, organic fair trade seems to be the bare minimum here.
Yeah.
And that just blew me away, because finding fair trade organic in Richmond is like good luck.
Because it's all Starbucks.
Absolutely. Yeah. Oh, Starbucks, Tim Hortons, right. You know, the non-coffees. So the fact that the Valley had all of these amazing coffee shops and that people were, you know, had different, we're supporting different ones. I just thought this is a community that knows good food. And mm-hmm. then we ate at Atlas, we ate at Locals, yep. and we just thought, oh my God, farms are shown on the menu. That's awesome. But obviously the clincher was finding the actual farm. So right. yeah, we found the land and the price was right. So yep. yeah, we took the leap. And so cool. we bought the farm a year and a half ago.
Okay.
My in-laws moved there first, and we bought the farm with my in-laws, which was okay. also what made it affordable. Because we were looking for just 5 acres.
Right.
But as we were looking, my in-laws also got really interested in coming out with us, which allowed us to buy way more than what we thought we could. So right.
So that's why the house yeah. is designed the way it is.
Yes, yes.
That's how Arzine and I met, is yeah. because I was working on their new house that they're having built on the farm, and I happened to, I saw you in the newspaper,
yeah,
in your press release, and I thought, I look at Kirby Road,
that's, I wonder the if farm. That's the
people, because I hadn't met you or Neil yet.
Yeah.
I had met your in-laws,
yeah.
they'd been around, and
yeah.
and so I was on my lunch break, and I just happened, you just showed up, and I thought, oh, I better go over and say yeah. hi and introduce myself, and then we chatted for 45 minutes,
yeah.
and I thought, oh, this is cool.
Awesome. So, awesome.
And that's how we got here.
Yeah.
But no, that's great. I mean, that's a really nice piece of land. You have 4 giant greenhouses.
Yeah.
And you got how many acres of pasture yeah. there?
There's 15 acres of hay field.
Right.
And 26 acres in total. So right. we got a lot of room to
you
work
can
with.
Do a lot of fun things.
Yes, yes. And what my husband keeps reminding me is that you're not on the sharing farm anymore. There's no army of young teenage boys out
yeah,
helping
right.
you. Don't overwhelm yourself.
Yeah.
So, right. Yes. Yeah. Okay. Thanks. Yes.
And
yes.
your kids aren't quite old enough to be
no,
your
no.
army yet.
They're,
so.
Not, they're not quite reaching the pedal on the tractor either. So
yeah.
not that I would let them go on that yet. So yes, we're starting really small, and you know, garlic was one of our first crops
right.
and it's such a great crop to grow here. And it grew really well considering the fact, you know, one of our big challenges is we didn't have animals in the last year that we were there. So we had no manure.
Right.
Mm. Trying to grow organically without manure is really expensive.
Right.
So luckily some neighbors took pity on us and gave us a small load of, you know, they had chicken and someone had a little bit of beef and like of cow manure. So
right.
We amended it really, really thinly with whatever we could find, and the garlic still grew really well, which tells me the soil's really great for that.
Right.
So, yeah, and not a stone to be found yet.
Oh, wow,
I know.
Beautiful.
Knock on wood.
Yeah.
But
I know I've done stone picking before.
Yeah.
It's not a fun job.
Yeah.
So.
I know. So, and being from Richmond, I mean, if you dig in Richmond, same with this farm that we have, and you hit something and it clinks, it's like, what the heck was that? Because,
right.
you know, Richmond has no stones either. Being, you know, river bottom,
it's, all,
right. it's just,
till,
it's so a right. heavy, heavy clay silt soil.
Right.
So, yeah, fun to work with in the spring, but very
yeah.
productive. So,
right. mm-hmm.
yeah.
And and you have chickens now?
We now have chickens. Yeah, that's been a fun new experience for
yeah.
us. Never having raised animals before. We
right.
thought, oh, how hard could it be? Chickens.
Yeah.
Know? Well, we got about 6 hens.
Yeah.
Just for us, for our own consumption.
Right.
And then the chickens are actually my daughter's, her project.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
So
cool.
she wants to sell eggs at the market.
Right.
So, okay. So we brought, and I thought for them, but she gets quite, you know, the big hens can be a little bit intimidating.
Right.
So I thought,
mm-hmm.
well, okay, we'll raise them from chicks. So
yeah.
we went over to Denman actually and picked up the chicks of probably every breed known to man. No, not quite, but we've got 2 of everything practically.
Oh, okay.
Just so that we can see what all the different temperaments are like.
Right.
And she wanted the really dark, she wanted a lot of like copper Moran, like so we could get the terracotta colored eggs
right.
and the Araucana, so we get green ones, green, green and brown. She
sure,
was a
yeah.
very Martha Stewart looking thing, I think
yeah.
she had in mind, but we got a bunch of different colors. And so, yeah, but they're not quite producing enough manure really for us to get any production. But hopefully next year, yeah, we'll have a nice production of eggs going.
Cool. Awesome. Are you going to do any meat birds at all, or are you just going to stick with the...
I think for now we're going to stick with just the layers.
Yeah.
But we did try an experiment last year when we were still living in Richmond and the farm was fairly not in production.
Right.
One of our neighbors asked to use one of the greenhouses to raise meat birds in.
Oh, okay.
And it worked really well because the meat birds then cleared out all the weeds.
Oh, sure.
And then fertilized it. And this year I'm growing popcorn in that greenhouse.
Oh, cool.
You have to see it. The corn is over 7 feet tall.
Wow.
It's like, wow. Yes, soak cool. up all that nitrogen. Yes, yeah. Thank you. There you go. So it was a really, it was a great way of kind of resting the land, having some animals on.
Yeah.
And then we, in trade for that, he gave us, you know, 10 birds.
Oh,
and
great.
That was awesome.
Excellent.
Yeah, and he took care of all of the animals, so that worked out well. So we might try that again.
Excellent.
Yeah.
It's good to have an animal that goes in and weeds and,
and
fertilizes.
And then makes something amazing out of it, too.
Yeah. Great system.
Yeah.
Yeah, all around. What else do you... Like, what else do you have a vision for the farm?
Well, you know, everyone's like, well, what kind of farm is it? Well, it's going to be a bit of everything farm. Mm-hmm. I'm really, really risk averse. I don't like putting all my eggs in one basket.
Right.
So I like to try a little bit of everything and see, because in any one year, something is going to fail.
Right.
This year, I mean, the squash patch is looking pretty sparse. Mm-hmm. And June was a total wipeout, and so many of the poor squash plants got eaten by the slugs and the rains that we had. So, I mean, we don't have too much. So I wouldn't have wanted to have acres and acres of squash and then had to deal with, you know,
till it all
that.
It
no
failed.
Kidding.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's so. Just going to be a little bit of everything, and we'll try and
So whatever comes up will be
what's
going out.
Yeah,
so.
Absolutely. And but because we have the greenhouses, we are kind of able to keep our production going well into the fall and winter.
Right.
So I'm hoping to do, you know, and because we just arrived in June, we didn't have time to plant, you know, a lot of the spring things.
Yeah.
So I'm actually looking at focus on fall and winter veggies. So
We've
got the kales and the peas and the leeks and carrots and beets for fall and winter. And now I'm going to start all of the Walla Walla onions and, you know, bok choys and guilans. See what the Comox Valley thinks of all the Asian vegetables.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
Why not?
Yeah.
Well, I know I'm a big fan of them, so I know there's a few people out there that definitely do like that stuff.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, and I just, whatever, that's interesting. John usually tells me about something cool, and I go try it. And,
yeah.
Or somebody like you at the market says, well, give this a shot.
Yes.
And then I'll take it home. And
I love growing Asian vegetables, I have to say. Mm-hmm. They, you know, are the climate when it's cloudy and sort of damp and coolish, like 12, 15 degrees, they love that kind of weather.
Oh, really?
And we have a lot of that kind
of
weather, right?
So
I'm going to take advantage of that and grow all the different bok choys and stuff. So,
cool.
Yeah.
How does the Comox Valley differ from Richmond as far as the variety of, of what we're growing here?
You know, there is so much growing here. In fact, when Neil and I first went to the farmer's market, before we'd even bought the farm, I was totally intimidated. I thought, oh my God, this is amazing. Look at all this food. Like, there's no niche that I can kind of plug myself. Well, no one's doing this because everybody's doing everything.
Right, yeah.
So one of the things, obviously, we noticed was the amount of meat that's still grown here.
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty much all but disappeared from Richmond because of the land prices.
Right.
So, and we have no cheese person in Richmond. There's no local cheese.
Right.
So the processed food is also, it's amazing.
Mm-hmm.
If we were to try and do a winter market in Richmond, I don't know, we might get, we wouldn't even get hazelnuts because the squirrels eat all our hazelnuts now. I mean, really, you just can't beat this area for the variety and the amount, like the number of farms here, it's amazing.
Yeah.
So
Yeah, there definitely is. There's something like 400 or 450 working farms in the valley.
Yeah, which is...
And then, I mean, they vary in size from a one
amazing.
Acre to...
Yeah.
I don't know how big the biggest ones are, 200, 500 acres.
And I think the official number in Richmond is something like 200 something.
Okay.
But of those who actually farm,
mm-hmm.
and of those who actually farm, do farm gate sales, I would say probably less than 40.
Really?
Wow. Yeah. Wow. And decrease, it was actually decreasing by two every year. Two family farms would shut down in Richmond, and you'd just be like, oh, where do I get my this from now?
Right.
So, yeah, it's so nice to see a very different sort of, and I think part, a lot of it has to do with people just really appreciating farms here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And people are getting concerned about where their food comes from more and more.
Well, I think part of that being an island, you know, when you're on Vancouver Island, you kind of got the, you've got the island mentality, like, oh my God, you know, what happens if the ferries stop or something? I mean, the stat's not very good. I think, what, 5% is self-sufficient for Vancouver Island?
Yeah, we have enough food here for 2 days at any one time.
I think actually about a week.
Yeah.
It would be about a week because you've got a bunch of wholesalers and stuff around the island.
Yeah.
But
right.
I think thrifties would be out if they were saying they'd be out within a week.
Yeah.
Which is scary.
Very scary, actually.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah. And the funny thing is Richmond, a lot of people forget that Richmond's an island, too.
Right, true.
And that the bridges and the tunnel connect it to everything else. But in the case of an emergency, oh, my God, how many blueberries can one person eat? I mean, that's basically what would feed Richmond.
Yeah.
But you certainly need more variety. You need all the vegetables and the meat people and everything, which is what the Comox Valley really has.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's, you know, so important for us to keep that in mind, that if something does happen, we have a storm, for a major winter storm or something like that, you know, there is a number of farms around here that have meat in their freezers that, you know, if you know where they are, you can
absolutely
go and purchase food from them, even if the grocery store doesn't have it.
Yeah.
That's why we're trying to make as many friends as possible on the show.
Yeah, exactly. It's our way of preparing for disaster.
Yeah. I mean, and absolutely.
And that's also another reason why I'm learning canning and fermenting and dehydrating. And I actually just killed my dehydrator the other day. It quit on me. I've had the thing for 12 years. Oh. I don't know how many things I've put through it.
Right.
And it's just a cheap Walmart dehydrator, so... I'm buying the exact same one again because I had such good luck with it. So
awesome.
12 years isn't bad for...
That's not for any kind of electronic piece of equipment. Yeah.
And now I have double the trays, so I'll be able to do more.
Yeah. That's another reason you stick with the same brand, because the trays and all fit.
Yeah. That's right. Totally. Yeah. So, yeah, but that's, you know, it's just really important to know where your food comes from and know that you can get it and you don't have to worry about it coming on a big truck from... who knows where or airplane and ferry to get it here.
The other thing that having that kind of diversity in your community really protects you from is, I don't know if you've seen what is happening to food prices now in the States because of the corn failure. And when your food is all highly processed stuff that is in packages, it's going to contain a corn product for sure, be it oil or sugar or something.
And probably wheat, too.
And and that type of food, the prices are going to really go up.
Yeah.
So, you know, someone was saying or complaining that they didn't like buying from the farmer's market because it was so expensive. And I said, are you kidding? I haven't seen prices at the farmer's market go up in years. Like, you know, a bunch of chard is still a couple of bucks.
Mm-hmm.
And it still will be even when the corn prices go up because, hey, all of our growers are good and the corn doesn't affect the price of chard. So
that's right.
Yeah.
And if the farmer's using organic methods, the price of fossil fuels doesn't really affect them either because they're not buying fertilizers.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, so. I mean, I noticed from in my industry that the prices are starting to balance out. There was a time that definitely local food was expensive.
Yeah.
You bought it and you had to charge extra because it was local.
Yeah.
And you had to explain to people why they were paying an extra dollar for something. But I'm starting to notice now that
it's competitive.
It's competitive. It's very starting
and
to
that's,
be on par.
It's interesting because I do notice that the prices in the Comox Valley, at least at the farmer's market, are way lower than they are in the lower mainland.
Right.
Like in the lower mainland, apparently, this may be just an urban myth, you can actually sell a bubble of garlic in Kitsilano for $5. I don't know about that. But I have certainly sold them for $3 or more. Whereas here, you know, no one would let you get away with that.
No, yeah, for sure.
Like, there's too many people growing it, so it does certainly help keep prices more affordable.
Yeah. I've had friends tell me how much they sell chanterelles for in Granville Island.
And you're laughing.
And I got a fridge full of them, and I'm going, huh, would it be worth the trip over?
Might pay for the ferry.
Yeah. Yeah. Sell them out of the back of my car.
Yeah.
Undercut the vendors by $4 or $5 a pound.
Wow.
Still make a lot of money.
Yeah.
Yeah. But another thing I wanted to touch on, this is kind of getting away from your farm in particular, but you mentioned spin farming to me when we talked before.
Yeah.
And I had a friend who's interested in doing something like that. And so if you could maybe just a little oversight on what
that
spin
is,
farming
what's
is.
What's that all
it's
about? Yeah.
Concept.
Yeah. So spin farming stands for small plot intensive. And it was actually developed by a gentleman out of Saskatoon, of all places. And he was a farmer and had a farm outside of Saskatoon. But his friends inside Saskatoon asked him to help garden in their backyards, and when he produced really well and had extra, they just told him, you know, sell it. And he was finding he was able to actually make more with his, you know, back and front yards in Saskatoon than he was on his own farm.
Right.
So he sold the farm and he started concentrating on this model full time. And so what it is, it's a really intensive method of production. You first of all get free land from homeowners.
Right.
People who, you know, have a big front or backyard and aren't using it, and you offer them, you know, produce in exchange.
Right.
You are growing a minimum of 3 crops in per bed per year.
Right.
So you're generally growing very high turnover crops, a lot of salad greens, a lot of Asian vegetables, stuff that's done in about 60 days.
Right.
And the beds are just never empty. So as soon as your frost is done, like, you're in there. And on the side, you're doing a lot of seed, like starting seedlings. So as soon as a crop goes out, something else is planted.
Mm-hmm.
And so Wally, the gentleman in Saskatoon, was able to actually make per square foot, he calculated $3. So if you just extrapolate, you know, to an acreage, and he had about an acre in production,
right.
That's over $120,000 an acre.
Whoa.
And he was doing
it in these little patchworks of front and backyards.
So he would just travel around town all day.
That's what he was doing. But, you know, that amount of return enabled him to do that, you know, to just concentrate on this. So he wrote a workbook, and it's now taken off, like, all over. It's really big in the, you know, in North America, where our front and back yards are still fairly big.
Right.
But it's traveled elsewhere too. And what's nice about it is that very low upfront costs.
Right.
Right? Mm-hmm. You approach homeowners and say, hey, you know, I'd like to do this. Do you want some produce? I'll garden. So the landowner provides the land and then the water.
Right.
And then in return, they get, you know, what they can either pick whatever they want, or you harvest and give them a portion of the harvest.
Right.
And so it works out really well for new farmers.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a really great kind of stepping stone into farming. So I started doing that about 4 or 5 years ago with a couple of friends. So the three of us are all working part-time or full-time and doing this on top of our other jobs.
Right.
And we only converted four yards.
Mm-hmm.
So 3 of them were backyards, 1 was a front yard. So we had maybe about 3,000 square feet in production, which is nothing. It's not even a percentage of an acre, really.
Yeah.
Right? And combining those 4 yards, we were able to start a CSA, a shared, a community supported agriculture. It's like a box program where people pay you up front and then you give them a weekly box of produce.
Right.
We were just talking about that tonight.
Yeah, over dinner, actually.
So.
And still, that was in Richmond, and it was still a pretty new thing in Richmond, but, you know, people really liked it. And so from 4 backyards, we had, well, at the height of the summer, we had 15 shares going out. And so it's a really great way of of growing food and then having a market for it. Mm-hmm. We also did farmers markets on the side. But I, you know, it's really stressful doing farmers markets, not like the Comox Valley farmers market. It goes from like 10 till 4. It's a whole day and you obviously you have to travel, you know, fairly far. But yeah, the CSAs really did appeal to us because we were also working part-time.
Right, yeah.
So, yeah, so spin farming, it's really catching on. And I'm noticing more and more folks doing that, especially in sort of city suburbs.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm quite interested in the concept.
Well, I'm willing to donate my yard.
Yay. That's all you need, right? If you put it out there. I mean,
open invitation, because I am the worst gardener, farmer ever. I know what to do with the food once it comes out of the ground, but before then, it's a complete disaster.
Oh my gosh. Yeah.
Apparently, you need water. And this is
something you do.
I'm fairly bad at.
Yeah, I know. I do a lot of dry land agriculture and, you know, your crops kind of suffer for it. They taste pretty intense, but you do need to have a fair amount of water.
With a few extra lengths of hose and a couple of timers,
you can set up. That's basically what we did.
Irrigation system.
Because we didn't want to go to every single garden every single day and turn the hose on and off. So we just went to, you know, Home Depot and picked up a whole bunch of timers.
It's fairly inexpensive.
It's pretty inexpensive,
I just have to put it in.
That's a matter of doing it.
Yeah.
No, I'm hoping to get a couple more. Like 4 more beds going in my front yard. Are you aware of hugel culture?
Yeah.
I'm going to do a hugel permaculture bed with some berries and a couple fruit trees. Sort of thing.
You should talk about this a bit more.
That's
hugel culture is it's a concept of basically you build a garden bed. There's many ways you can do it, but you build a garden bed. The base of it is some rotting wood, and then you put compost on top of that, and then your growing medium, your soil, on top of that. The idea is that the wood soaks up water in the winter time, in the rainy time, and so it'll slowly evaporate out and help keep the ground moist for your plants. And it works especially well with permaculture because your perennial plants, the roots will sink down into that wood where the water is more available. So it cuts down the amount of watering you need to do.
And it's a really inexpensive way of building a bed. Because if you've ever built a raised bed, I mean, getting soil in, it's and the wood sides and the whole, it's not cheap.
No. I probably will do mine with some lumber sides.
Yeah.
But instead of digging down or building it in a mound, I'll just do a double high, like a 2x12 bed. And then I'll put the bottom layer as wood or a bit more, and then soil and compost on top of that. So. Yeah,
great
I'm excited
system.
About trying it out.
Great system.
And I was thinking about strawberries and blueberries and maybe a couple dwarf fruit trees in there.
And you got to try a tayberry.
I've been hearing about tayberries.
It's
another new thing. Is this like a garlic scape?
Okay, so here's a bit of history. And I didn't mention this in my history because it was only one summer. But my first job in agriculture after my first year of university was actually here in the Comox Valley.
Oh, really? Oh.
So I got a job at a place called, at that time it was called the Berry Patch. And it was owned by a gentleman named Peter Jones. Mm-hmm. And he grew, I think it was about 20 different types of berries.
Oh, wow.
So he had all of the currants, black, red, gooseberries, strawberries, I mean, all the regular ones. But then he had tayberries, loganberries, marionberries. I mean, there's berries that, we probably have no idea what they are.
Right.
And he was growing all of them. And so I think it was then, that my first introduction to tayberries. Now, that was back in...
You don't have to give it an
19,
exact
date. It's good. It's good. 1989, that probably would have been. So they were here. Mm-hmm. And there are a few places I know in the Lower Mainland that do have tayberries. Now, they are like a very elongated raspberry crossed with a blackberry.
Oh, okay. That's what I was trying to remember.
Yeah.
A blackberry and a raspberry.
Yeah, so
sort of.
A little bit more of a sour note to the flavor, but a lot more eating. It makes a fabulous pie. Mm. Tayberry pie is amazing.
I hear it doesn't travel as well.
No, probably.
Which is sort of a problem that most people haven't got it.
Yeah.
Raspberries are similar like that too. They're really delicate.
And you got to use them ASAP. Yeah.
Never been a problem at my house.
They disappear. Yeah.
I'll be mostly growing berries for winter storage, so
they'd
be perfect.
Great.
Straight off the bush, straight into the freezer.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I picked a lot of strawberries this early summer, and I'm trying to pick blackberries right now, and they're everywhere. I just have to find the time to do it.
I know. Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're definitely lucky here for berries. Like blueberries, blackberries.
Great. Yeah.
Huckleberries, salmonberries.
Yeah.
Our wild berries are amazing.
They are.
You go up to somewhere where it's been a logging cut, you know, a couple year old logging cut, and there's all kinds of berries.
Well, I mean, we're trying to still explore the Comox Valley. So for my birthday, we did a bike ride through Seal Bay Park. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't decide whether or not I wanted to bike or just sit there and eat all the huckleberries. Like, I've never seen anything like that.
Oh, yeah.
Where
yeah.
they're just growing and they're huge just by the side of the path.
The huckleberry crop was unreal this
year. Yeah.
I know we went out mountain biking a couple of weeks ago, my friend and I, Russ, from the Comox Valley $100 Challenge. And he ended up getting a flat tire, which was kind of a drag. But the whole time we walked out of the trail, we were just eating.
Eating, yes.
So our trip took a little longer, but there was huckleberries and wild raspberries and blackberries and thimbleberries, salmonberries.
Yep.
Yeah. Red elderberries. Terrible.
Red elderberries?
Oh, they're awful.
Good to know.
We tasted them just because we're weird like that and we just eat things. And
I think the purple one's meant to be the eating one. And
But anyways, he just thought, well, let's try it. So we, not good at all.
They need to be worked into something else.
Mm-hmm. Well, I read about them in a book, and it said, not recommended for eating. They're not poisonous, but they're not good
for eating
taste.
Off-putting.
Did.
Right.
So don't eat red elderberries.
Well, good to know. Good to know.
I did have a little question for you just about, we haven't talked much about organic foods. So what is more important? Is organic or sustainable, local?
That's a tough question.
It's kind of a loaded question.
It is.
Yeah.
Well, you know, for me, I've spent like the last 15 years working, teaching organic production and working with organic farmers. So for me, organic production is really huge. Part of the whole sustainability, I think it's on a spectrum of sustainability. And, you know, I do think there are organic growers like organic from California. I don't know if that's really considered a sustainable organic, but local and organic, I think, is the marrying the best of both worlds.
Right.
And I think the more, you know, folks can talk about that and ask their farmers what they're using in their production. We had, you know, some issues in Richmond where farmers are advertising on roadside stands or where that their berries are organic. And doing the research, I looked up to see who is certified organic in Richmond. And there is one farm that's certified organic, and it's an egg farm. There are no vegetable or berry farms in Richmond that are certified. So when people say that their stuff is organic and it's not certified, I don't find that to be quite as truthful.
Right.
You know, so not to say that if you know someone personally and you know what they are and what they're like, that you can trust them, but someone who's selling to the general public, I mean, not everybody knows their farmer personally. I think it just helps with the integrity of the whole situation. Like for us, you know, no one knows us from a hole in the wall. We just show up at the farmer's market and say that our stuff is organic. Well, I would hope people would ask, you know, who's your certifier? And
right.
So we don't advertise our stuff as organic because we're not certified.
You're not certified.
Right.
But we're hoping to go along that way. So I think it's big because there's a lot of
and there's a lot of groups that certify
which
is hard to tell
and
they have different standards
they do but in general you know all the stuff that you're worried about like no pesticides no synthetic fertilizers no GMOs
mm-hmm.
all of them do there's that minimum right? So some of them for posts some of them might allow treated posts some don't I mean there's a few other things but in general they're all basic in their minimum standards for sure.
See, I heard that organic or farmed salmon is going to be allowed to be tagged organic.
Yeah.
And that just about killed me. I actually kind of lost it and I wrote a big letter to a couple of government people and I tend to do that once in a while.
That is going to shake things up a lot. I know a lot of organic growers very unhappy about that.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm just going to put it out there. It's not going to happen.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's not going to be.
Yeah.
Well, it's the same as, you know, organic beef or organic chicken. You know, like, is it organic because it's in a cage getting fed organic feed? Mm. Or is it organic because it's running around somebody's yard eating whatever it wants?
Yeah.
Or is the organic label so strict that it has to, the feed has to be traced? I mean, to me, an organic chicken is one that gets to forage freely and you know, and do what a chicken should do, not sit in a cage and eat.
Absolutely.
Eat organic corn meal.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Mixed with organic pork meal. Yes.
Well, I have to say, you know, having raised eggs for the first time, layers, I have never seen, and we, you know, we do let our chickens run, and I've never seen yolks that yellow. At first, I thought something was wrong.
Yeah.
You know, I was like, because, you know, we do also make the effort of using only certified organic feed.
Right.
Because, you know, I'm not, I don't want to support GMOs, so, and that's important for me and the family.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I thought, oh, okay, well, maybe it's the feed, but no, it, you know, having them peck and having them graze on grass makes a huge difference.
Oh, yeah, those bugs in there and stuff.
Oh,
like
absolutely. Yeah. These are like, oh my, I've never seen eggs like this on the market. Even, you know, buying $7 certified organic eggs in the supermarket are not like these eggs.
No.
Yeah.
No, and then you can buy them from somebody's roadside for $3.50, $4 a dozen.
Yeah.
Not $7.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, it's not expensive.
Yeah.
Eggs are not expensive. No.
Mm-hmm. So even at $5 a dozen, they're still not expensive.
Yeah, no. Yeah. And they're, you know, the chickens are
absolutely
doing what they're supposed to
do.
So what's your thoughts on backyard hens? This is another issue that I've
I just tweeted about this. So necessary.
Yeah.
For many, many reasons. You know, we don't have enough eggs in the Comox Valley. We didn't have any in Richmond. Richmond doesn't allow backyard hens.
Right.
But I think for people to get, again, if we're talking about getting in touch with your food and knowing where your food comes from, I think, you know, giving people the ability to raise hens in an urban environment, that's where I'm assuming you're talking about, is big. And, you know, hens don't really, they don't create as much noise or as much smell as maybe even a dog.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're, often most cities limit it to maybe 4 to 6 hens per family.
Right.
No roosters. So totally doable in an urban environment.
Yeah.
Yeah.
For sure. No, it's something I'm very interested in. And it's a endeavor of mine to correct some of these laws that.
Yes.
Are not allowing them right now.
And count me in. Yeah.
Roosters seem to ruin it for everyone because they think of waking up at 6 in the morning to the sunrise. So.
Yeah.
But and you can be woken up to your neighbor's dog barking at the same, or in the middle of the night.
Yeah.
So.
And hens they're awesome. Yeah. They convert your food garbage into something amazing.
Yeah.
And they give you manure, give you eggs, give you meat. Yeah.
Yeah, it's just a win-win.
It is. Yeah. And I, you know, it goes again, the whole food system that we're talking about. We waste so much food in North America.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm not a big fan of carting our food waste off to another site to be composted.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I think every family needs to deal with as much food waste as they can at home.
I have a hard time with composting at home because we have bear problems in Cumberland. And I've had the regular Earth Machine composters.
Yeah.
And my first one got destroyed by bear. It's still usable, but it got broken.
Yeah.
So I bought another one and the same problem. It just kept coming back. So I built one out of a plastic barrel with a latchable lid. So I'm hoping that it'll survive.
Seems to be okay.
But I built a worm bin.
Yeah. Because
I thought, you know what? Bear's not going to come up onto my deck in the backyard, most likely. I'll build a worm bin, give it a shot. Seems to be working pretty good. It's not perfect, but, you know, they're doing what they're supposed to do. They're eating the food scraps.
Yes, And creating probably a product you wouldn't even be able to buy.
Yeah,
you know,
for sure.
Awesome.
And so, yeah, anyways, it's just kind of a fun project.
Yeah.
And some good compost from them.
Well, I think we should, we're into an hour here, which is perfect. So we'd like to thank you so much for
sitting
down and chat with us.
Welcome.
So I think we've learned quite a bit today, actually.
Yeah,
so
maybe we'll have a revisit with you in a few months when
anytime.
The winter crops are happening.
Absolutely. Yeah, I can let you know what did work, what did not. Yeah. Yes.
And I know I mentioned to you about sweet potatoes.
Mm.
Is that something that can be grown here?
It's possible.
Yeah.
At the Sharing Farm, maybe about 4 years ago, we tried sweet potatoes. We had one of our interns was from UBC. Mm-hmm. And her supervisor was doing some trials on sweet potato slips. So we were able to get, you know, the actual slips and we planted them. Now they grew. We planted them through clear plastic and had drip lines under the plastic. And they grew. The only thing is we didn't know when to harvest them and what to. Well, and the vines just, I mean, it's kind of like growing squash, you know, the vines will just take over and cover the whole area.
Oh, okay.
And I didn't even realize the vines were also edible too. And
right.
That's big in Filipino culture.
Okay.
But by the time we harvested them, they were monstrous. Like we should have harvested them way earlier. So they do like hot and dry. But I think it's doable.
Cool. Yeah. I'm, cause that's something that it's not available locally and it's something, and I'm a paleo eater, so that's my substitute for potatoes. Is sweet potatoes, so that's something I could get locally. It would be awesome.
Yeah.
But who knows? Maybe I'll try growing some too.
Yeah.
Give them a shot. Okay. Well, thanks, Arzina.
You're welcome.
Great visit and a great interview. What's the upcoming events, John? We're kind of, our list is shrinking here.
We have to find some new events get some new stuff going. I know there's lots. Big time out was this weekend up in Cumberland.
Yeah, so you said the restaurant was smoking busy this morning.
Smoking busy.
Wow.
So we were, Friday was a little bit on the slower side, but it picked up for Saturday and Sunday was crazy.
Yeah, so. I came home yesterday from Tree Island and the main street of Cumberland was just packed with people. So
yeah.
I think all the restaurants and vendors in Cumberland did really well this weekend.
Yeah, so there's a lot of people around.
What I've heard, the event was well organized and there was not too much problems for the police or anything. So that's excellent.
So I guess the big ones coming up would be this weekend coming up. We have, so the 24th coming up.
Yeah.
24th, 25th, and 26th, the Exhibition Grounds are having the
their
big events going on.
Yeah.
And so there'll be lots of events happening there. Baking, canning.
Yeah.
Chickens and ducks.
They have a petting zoo and
lots of great stuff for kids to come and do and get in and be a part of a farm, I guess. So.
Yeah.
Also, Mount Washington has their Food and Wine Festival going on.
Mm-hmm.
So I think they're putting together a market up on there on the Friday.
Oh, cool.
Oh, okay.
Not 100% sure, but I know I've seen some emails and stuff about stuff they're trying to get going up there.
Yep.
I know they were asking the Chefs Association if we'd send a couple people they're interested to volunteer and help up or maybe set up a booth. So I don't know how that's coming along because it was a little bit of short notice for us, but... so there's some stuff happening up there. I think we're still online for Chef's Day at the Farmer's Market. I mean, lots of stuff happening at the Farmer's Market right now. So, especially with all the vegetables coming in.
Yeah, everybody's got absolutely loaded stands right now.
Yeah, I was down there filling out a survey this weekend, so that was fun. I guess they're trying to find out what people want and what they're doing down there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, good.
Yeah, so the Chef's Day is September 8th, so trying to get a bunch of chefs down there just to have some fun. So,
yeah,
I'll be... checking in with the rest of the Chefs Association next Monday, so I'll find out where we're all sitting with that stuff. So.
Cool.
What else we got going on?
The North Island Picnic. Flavor.
I think we're up. I just saw on Facebook today that they've sold 300 tickets. So they're shooting for 400.
Awesome.
Considering we have just under a month till cutoff for tickets. I think that's looking really good.
Yeah.
So it probably will sell out. So if you haven't got your tickets, I would definitely get in there and start doing it.
Don't look at me.
I know.
Oh, wait. You should be looking at me.
Yeah. I'm still working on my food safety plan.
Right.
Which means I actually have to finalize what I'm going to do for a meal there.
Yep.
So, but I've got, I'm working with BC Wild Salmon.
Nice.
So we'll be doing some nice sockeye salmon fillets out there. So
cool.
Thinking about doing a Gravlax. Playing with that with a little bit and adding
some
flair
smoking.
To it.
Yeah,
I'm not too sure exactly how I'm going to do it yet. So
yeah, I've never done that before. Cold smoke.
Cold
different,
smoke, yeah.
Much different.
And yeah, that's basically, I'm just going to do it in salt. And, and some, I'm thinking about beets.
Oh, yeah.
Get some nice purple in there. Nice. So we'll see how that all works together.
Yeah. We'll try and get some guests in the next couple of weeks that are associated with flavor. Because it's
The organizers want to sit down with us and tell us what's going on. Because I know we're looking at about 50 vendors right now. Mm. So that's a good,
huge
turnout.
Yeah,
so
it's big.
We could probably handle more than 400 people, but I don't know if they want to go there.
Yeah.
I know they're excited because Czech TV is signed on as a sponsor, and there's a lot of other big sponsors that have joined in. So
yeah, just goes to show how big the food culture is locally, eh?
Yeah, and how excited people are for an event like this. So
yeah, great. And yeah, the Comox Valley $100 food challenge is still going. The momentum slowed a little bit with new people joining, so you know, if you're interested in keeping a little bit of your money locally and supporting our farmers, join the Facebook page and spend $100 or more of your grocery money locally versus at the grocery store.
And I guess I got one last event. It's not scheduled yet, but apparently there's going to be a garlic festival in the Comox Valley.
Yeah.
2013.
Yes. We'll put that down. Shooting
absolutely.
For that date.
Absolutely.
I think you just got us signed up for something, John.
Nice. Nice. Well, look out also for in September, at the end of September, for some kind of kale event.
Oh, okay.
Yes. I have a friend, Sharon Hanna, who wrote the Book of Kale, and she wants to do a book signing here in the Comox Valley.
Cool.
So we're looking at the 27th of September in Comox.
Okay.
And but I hope that we can also schedule a couple more dates, maybe even at the farmer's market for her to do some stuff.
Yeah, cool.
Kale. Everyone's got to eat kale.
Yeah.
It's good stuff.
Kale is great that it's always in my garden.
Yeah.
And chickweed and dandelions and, yeah, all the things that most people pull out, I pull out and put on my plate.
Absolutely.
And wild mushroom season's getting close too, and I'm just getting very excited, so I wanted to throw that out there.
Yeah, wild mushroom season, yes.
Yeah. So we're going to do an Edible Valley Goes mushroom picking something or other. We'll have to get a hold of a video camera or something.
And we're going to get a group together and go.
Yeah.
Sign me up.
We've got a few guests that are interested, so yeah. We got another one now. So we'll see what we can organize with that. So that'll be a lot of fun. Thanks for listening to the Edible Valley Podcast. Check out our website, ediblevalley.podbean.com. Like us on Facebook and follow our Twitter feed at Edible Valley. Email us with your comments or who you want us to have on the show, ediblevalley@gmail.com. Thanks for listening, and remember, keep it local.